Right, I'm going to talk about corks. Bubbling in the bathwater. I have loved Jacob and hated Esau, saith the Lord. Why should God say, I have loved one human being and hated another human being? The answer is that Jacob means, in the lexicon, it means supplanter, cunning fellow. Fellow that can take your heritage away from you surreptitiously. But it really means something else. It means affirm the secret. Affirm coverage. Do not expose all your weapons. Now Esau means a hairy man, a wild man, an uncivilized man, a person of impulse, and a person prepared to swap his heritage for a pair of chopsticks and a bowl of Egyptian beans. One chopstick is quite easy to handle beans with. Two beans, one chopstick. The idea is that the nomadic peoples of the world were not going to make a civilization. You see this in modern Iran and in Afghanistan and such like places. Wherever there are nomadic peoples today, they are progressively being displaced by the founders of settled civilizations. And if we don't make a civilization, we cannot build a mathematical, geometrical, logical, scientific world. The nomad riding his camel or his pony doesn't build a great science such as we see today. If we had all nomads for our ancestors, we'd be coming here on camels or donkeys or even on each other. Because you know that a long time ago, the weaker people in the head and stronger in the leg were used as ponies by rather overweight, wealthy, intelligent men. But you wouldn't have been coming in a car. You would not have been coming in a reciprocating engine device, nor a turbine device. Those of you who have turbines driving your car, stand up and be recognized as in the mode. You'd either be on foot or riding on some creature, and you would not be civilized. You wouldn't be sitting on chairs. You might sit on the floor, like nomadic people do. You might make good carpets, like nomadic people do, because they put those on the floor so that they don't immediately get eaten by beetles and ants. I have loved Jacob because he made the great civilization. And his brother Esau was a wild, uncontrolled, non-civilizer. Now hate, what does hate mean? Hate means that a power structure shall be fixated so that it cannot move. So the directive is the moving nomadic person was fixated in his development. He couldn't develop in civilization because he was roaming about. Whereas the man that settled down and made a city and made agriculture to feed the city and made an army to defend the agriculture and the city, made a science to equip the army, that man is not fixated. So the apparently fixated man, the city-dwelling fellow, is somehow not fixed at all, because his intellect is developing and he is gradually acquiring more and more power, more and more knowledge of the whole universe. It couldn't be a nomadic people that put the first men on the moon. It couldn't be a nomadic people that have got somewhere wandering beyond the orbit of Pluto. Some kind of device that can travel to the furthest stars. A nomadic people cannot build that kind of concept. So the hate means fixate the power of the inefficient. You know that in Indian philosophy, Shiva is the destroyer, Brahma is the creator, Vishnu is the preserver, and Shiva is the destroyer. Destroyer of what? Destroyer of the useless, destroyer of rubbish. And therefore the preserver of anything whatever that is useful and progressive. Now I said I was going to talk about corks. And we'll see here how this applies. We all know today, as a matter of fact, not fantasy, that matter can be broken down and demonstrated to be energy. So we have to think about the universe as a great ocean of energy. And we know by the rotation of the planets around the sun and the whole solar system rotates around another point in a star system far away, all reality is rotational. So if we imagine the greatest rotation that we can, and then call that the big universe, you could say macrocosmos if you like, or go even bigger, megalocosmos, the biggest of the big. Now imagine a colossal ocean, spherical. You know our word ocean is from a Greek word, and that word meant a circular river. Oceanos means a circular river surrounding the universe. It was merely their mythological expression for the universe is a rotating energy system. Now, therefore, we can say, imagine, there's a couple of friends of mine here tonight, and they've got a fair approximation to a circular bath. You can have a circular bath as well as a long one. So imagine that the whole universe is a vast ocean, circular, surrounded by a spinning belt of power to keep it in, and call it the Megalo bath, call it big bath, call it the big universe. And the word bath and beth means house, the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, a dwelling, a place in which you can live. Now imagine a vast house, the biggest house we can imagine, made of pure power. And beyond this bath, this dwelling, this macrocosmos, there is infinite power, non-rotating. Think about that very carefully. Imagine an infinite ocean that wasn't rotating at all, extending in six directions, at right angles to each other, three planes of being, extending with no edges. If it had no edges, it could not be. The word be means to be, encapsulate. It means to rotate, to circulate. If energy scatters and doesn't begin to rotate again, it is lost in infinity. Now, to stop the loss of infinite energy in infinity, a simple device, the sentient power, which we call the Godhead, spun the power, made it spin round, and in so doing established a big bath, a big universe. The letter M, the Mem of the Hebrew, signifies the water in the bath, and also substance, because water is plastic, water can assume the shape of any vessel whatever, so water is the perfect type of an original prime material. Now imagine within that vast spherical ocean, that great cosmic bath. I said cosmic there, the case of closure that holds it in and stops it dissipating. Now we have likewise a skin, an integument, which holds our body in. Our body is nearly all water, with a few chemical precipitates in it. to turn that water into an electrolyte so that nervous impulses can be transmitted in it. So imagine sitting inside your skin is an ocean of life fluid. We call it protoplasm, sort of colloidal jelly-like substance. Now, remember that S equals P. Sentience is power. And remember, you cannot have a dualism, because an ultimate dualism would have two fundamental entities, utterly different, and if they were utterly different, they could not interact. But they do. Our sentience and our power interact. Sentience is our capacity to feel, and power is our capacity to change the form of our being, the form of our action, the mode in which our feeling expresses itself. So we can say S equals P. Sentience equals power. The power is our ability to move. The sentience is our capacity to know that we move. Now in this vast spherical ocean of sentient power, there is a capacity for self-mobilization. The self there is a capital S and means the whole sphere of the great universe. Now inside this sphere, there is a process of turbulence, turba, turnings, which make little turnings within the big turning. And the little turnings go right down to subatomic level. There's a halfway between the smallest subatomic particle and the biggest system of stars we can see. Halfway between is the human being. Human being is a halfway being between the infinitely small and the infinitely large. And I'm going to ask you to imagine that this human being is a little turning system, quite complex because it's made of even smaller turnings. And it's halfway between the smallest and the largest of the turnings. In the Bible it says, when time ceases, there will be no shadow of turning. What we call shadow in the universe is a function of turning. If all the energy in the Earth didn't go round, or to the other planets, the Earth could not cast a shadow. The sun, not meeting a rotating energy, would go straight on. There would be no shadow. So it's not just a mythical guess. But the end of time is the cessation of turning. There will be no shadow of turning at the end of time. At the end of time, everything returns into an absolute condition of sentient power, not rotating, but fully conscious of all the rotations that have ever been made by it and constituting for it cosmic memory. Now we, as halfway systems of turnings between the minutest and the greatest, we are like a little cork. I want you to look at the word cork, C-O-R, the basis of core, heart, this thing. Any frogs in the audience will have an approximation to that word. And also the British English word courage, courage, courage. It's in the heart, it's in the feeling. Now think of the word cork symbolizing course, that is, say, running round, closed. The K on the end of the word cork means to close. And inside the closure, there is a running around, a coursing, which makes a heart. You know, our own heart, four-chambered, is actually produced by a circulation of energy in the developing embryo. The rotation builds the heart. And that core, the same core in the word chorus, that core is a running around within an enclosure. Now imagine that throughout infinite space, in that great megalocosmos, there are an infinity of little corks bobbing about, and they are human beings. But remember, the cork is not a different substance from the energy of the ocean in which it floats. How many of you in your holiday travels through oceans have looked over the edge of the boat and seen a vast number of jellyfish swimming in the sea? You've seen them? And you've noticed they're very hard to see. If they hadn't got a fine skin on to make a highlight, you couldn't see them. They're actually swimming zones of seawater. Yeah? Now, our chemistry is very similar to that of seawater. We're really jellyfish who have deposited some calcium and other minerals to make internal skeletons to lean on, to rest on. Those jellyfish swim quite nicely, but they get carried along by the oceanic currents. Now, we've risen out of that, and we say we are not going to be carried along by external forces that compel us to do things we don't want to do. In a very high wind, in a very high storm, many jellyfish get thrown onto the beach and perish. But we don't like perishing on beaches. So we have worked very hard and thought very hard, and we have been like Jacob. We have Yaakov. We have affirmed the secret. We have kept the secret of supremacy inside ourselves. We are self-determinant. And we have encouraged other forms of life, like the jellyfish, to believe that they are carried away by fortune, by the conditions around them. We have encouraged them to believe that they have no internal self-will, that they can't go where they want. They're not reflexive. In the ancient world, in ancient Egypt, in Babylon, in Greece, in India, in China, there were two kinds of beings. And the beings that made the definitions defined themselves as gods. And by gods, they meant self-moving, essential spiritual beings, self-determinant, conditioning their own motions, making their own decisions, and doing whatever they will to do. And then they said, and the rest, those who are not self-determinant, those who take orders from those who are self-determinant. And they call themselves the elect. And they kept that a very, very great secret. An elect race. Hitler stole the idea for a time, but he hadn't got the wherewithal to keep it. The real elect don't mention it. That is to say, they don't put their chief trick on the table, face up, to their opponents. They conceive life as an ocean full of fish, and the fish are like the corks swimming about, bobbing up and down. And they have a rule: if it weren't for the sharks, there'd be no fast swimmers. You know that one. If it weren't for the tigers, if it weren't for the lions, there'd be no fast deer. If it weren't for the very clever fellows, the other ones would not wake up. So the very clever ones have a function, namely advancing the evolution of the rest. Now, there are many people that have claimed to be the elect. And probably one of the earliest of all of them were the Brahmins of India. But the same thing occurred in China, the Son of Heaven, in Japan, the Emperor, and some of the Roman emperors putting on a radiation like a sun and saying, I am a god. But they knew what they meant when they said a god. They meant a being of total self-determination who is not enslaved by the initiative of other beings. So spiritual essential means initiative. The spirit means initiative, here nowness. Essential means precipitating the very beingness of that spirit into manifestation, into incarnation. Insofar is you have a body, and you can persuade that body to move at your will, you are a god. In so far as when you tell it to get up on a cold morning, it doesn't, you are a slave to the temperature. Now imagine, in the cosmic bath, a fantastical number of corks bobbing up and down. And each cork is a human being. But the cork, like the jellyfish, is made of the same energy that makes the cosmic ocean. Now what happens if a power, a force, from beyond cosmos, we call that para, cosmic power, energy, comes in to the system, hits one of the corks. Now that cork goes up and down in a bit more agitated manner than the other corks that it hasn't hit. And the cork that receives that extra energy is said to enthuse. Enthusiasm really means God, that is initiative, that is spirit power, has entered into that individual. But the moment that cork goes up and down more than other corks around it, something happens to the other corks. What is it? Can you tell me? Envy. Envy. Now look at the word envy. It's made of the first part of the word, the end part, E-N. Actually means being. It means life, movement. And the V-Y means developmental affirmation. When one moves first with initiative, the other thinks, I could have done that if I'd have thought of it. That is the history of invention. If I had thought of it. Well, how do you get to the point where you can, if you're a cork, bobbing up and down, get to the point where you can bob yourself without waiting for a blow from paracosmic energy coming in to hit you and say, wake up. When energy comes from paracosmos into cosmos and hits an individual cork, he is said to be inspired. He becomes enthusiastic. But that is said to be an act of grace, and grace means free. It means the bondage of the G, the hard G, the Gimel, has been broken. And then it emerges in that very being suddenly a Ra, a differentiating, discriminating, ruling power. How do you get it without waiting for grace? Change the timing. How do you do that?
If all the corks are bobbing up and down at the same time, mm-hmm. all 4 seconds, the rest will go down, and this one will bob them.
That's a very good solution. Change the timing. I think that either Peter at the moment is inspired from above, or he's been reading the very deepest Hindu philosophy, which says change the timing. Yeah? Just change the timing. Timing of what? We will now attack your brain even more, and we will become vampires on your intelligence, and we will suck your mental blood. Tell us more. How does an individual change his timing?
By first of all recognizing that you are part of the whole cork. Not.
Would you mind coming up here, please, Peter? Face that way, please. You carry on your discourse now, have a rest. He's got the perfect solution. So when you say it loud and clear, please.
By recognizing that you're part of the whole cork, first of all, and then for one moment tense, and the rest of the being then will go down, the rest of the cork will go down. You would stay above for a moment, and then the timing has changed, so this starts to happen.
Yeah, and this fellow had the nerve to tell me he wasn't Jewish. Why did you say you weren't Jewish? You come up with a totally Hebraic solution. Did you believe you weren't, or were you just pulling my leg?
No.
We're all Jewish in a way, right. Do you want to carry on and I'll continue resting, or would you like to rest?
Oh,
you. You carry on. You carry on. Tell me when you're ready, if ever. Am I allowed to lie down?
No, like for instance now, I feel the point of being compelled to sit down because that would be the easiest way to act at this moment.
But you're not going to. There is an up-bob in court. A successful businessman in his own right, self-rising court in the cosmic ocean, doomed to become a millionaire. Say hello to him now while you've got the opportunity. You don't mind me interfering, do you?
No, that's something else I'll put to get you to be interfering. Because it isn't actually interference.
It is actually interference.
Then again, you see, that's the same point again. It's a matter of saying, well, do I accept what you've just said? And although it's the truth, it means just having a look, listen to it, reposit it into your mind and then say, yes, I accept that is the truth, not just to go along with it.
In other words, when you see a truth, you have to see it and make it yours before you agree with me.
Yes.
So you're not agreeing with me, you're agreeing with your own insight.
Yes.
Fine. If we can all do that, we're doing very well indeed. Never accept anything that's true from another person until you first appropriate it, discover it for yourself, and then accept it because you personally have made the discovery of it. And then you're not indebted at all to the other person, are you?
No.
No.
Just to that point, you know, we've talked before about stealing.
Yes.
And it would have been for a time because I was thinking about this idea of stealing. How can it be that I'm stealing? And it's just a matter of reorientating yourself to realising what stealing means.
Yes.
It's quite correct in saying that it's what other people have said to keep you in order.
Mm.
But really, you're not stealing, you're using the bounties of God to...
Very good. And again, Hindu philosophy. One of my Hindu friends worships a goddess, very well known in India, and the worship consists in stealing and telling lies. And it's still worship. Depends how you see it. And whether worshipping your goddess you don't mind if some other people worshipping another god or goddess throw you in jail. If being thrown into jail alters your form of worship, you're not a true believer. Would you like to carry on now?
As time goes along, it becomes more and more difficult.
That's only a matter of energy and form.
You could say that I put myself in a position, really, that I have to stay here all the time until I can accept that is.
You said you put yourself there, didn't you?
Yes.
Was that strictly true?
Yes.
It was.
Yes.
You didn't need an external stimulus to get you there.
It may. I allowed the energy that was put forward was then allowed to act in whichever way it would have done anyway.
Very good, yes. In other words, regardless of what I said, he'd be up here. It's true, you know, it's true, because constituted as he is, I know very well how he's going to respond. Because I look at what is, not at what isn't. And I know one or two gentle soul people that would not have risen to the bait. Wouldn't I? I wouldn't ask Greta to help me. She'd help me immediately. Like you. And I'd have to look around for somebody who's a bit tardy of being helpful. And then pass quickly over it. Would you like to accept another sitting in the list and sit down now?
I'll sit down now.
Thank you. I think that's worth a round, you know. And Peter's solution is perfectly correct. The cosmic ocean of sentient power precipitates corks, and say heart centers, closed with an integument around them, and we are such centers, whether we like it or not, as the Muslims say. Whether we like it or not, we are centers of power, of hierarchy. The core aspirate the K sound, you got the same sound, core, C-H-O-R. Hierarchy of power inside the closed integument. But observe, as Peter said, all you have to do is remember that fundamentally the jellyfish is only ocean. The jellyfish is seawater. Now, if it identifies with the integument and thinks, I am only a self-jellyfish up to the limit of my integument, it has fallen. Supposing it goes worse, it contracts itself very tightly. It makes a shell. Like the crustaceans, like a crab. That's a bit harder than a jellyfish. You know that the crustacea, the crabs and so on, have gripped themselves tighter than the jellyfish because they're more scared. Now we're going to have three little terms, and we'll borrow them from Hindu philosophy. We could do without them, but we won't because we're lazy. Brahman means that ocean, the greatest ocean we can think of, which is binding itself. Para Brahman means beyond that outermost bound into the infinite. Brahman is that great ocean of sentient power. Now, inside it, the cork, or the jellyfish, inside its integument, is called Atman, A-T-M-A-N. I want you to see that like a jellyfish, and it's not too tight. It's a very loose one. It's very, very, very near to being Brahman, with a thin integument. Very, very thin skin. So thin, on a grey day you couldn't see it. You need the highlighter of the sun to be able to spot. There is a monad. There is a one. Within the infinite Brahman, there is a one. And she's a one, jellyfish, a one, monad, a one, Atman. So we're now distinguishing there the Brahman, that great cosmic sentient power, from a zone within it which is relaxed, but still zoned. And then we're going to remember the crab, with its hardened shell tightened up within the Atman, because it's defensive. That's J-I-V-A, Jiva. That Jiva means the affirmed individual for developmental activity. It's now going to try to develop all the possibilities of finitude within the infinite. I think beyond the Brahman is Para Brahman. Para means beyond, P-A-R-A. Beyond the Brahman, we say nothing, it is beyond. But when we mention the Brahman, we mean this great, fantastical sphere of sentient power, and inside it, lots of little spheres, relaxed, like jellyfish, and they are Atman. They are yourself in a non-fearing, relaxed condition, responding to the undulations of the Brahmanic ocean. And then, sometimes, it occurs that a given cork is hit by a force and bobs violently up and down, and then defends itself against the interference terrified of illumination by the God Absolute, and it shrinks, and at that moment it hardens its outermost boundary and becomes a crustacean. It's like a crab. And you know, by the way, crabs run sideways, they give you evidence. They're terribly fearful. You've got very, very strong nippers, very hard, case on them. And the degree of the hardness is the degree of the fear. And I just think this is true for every being, including human beings. To the degree that you're afraid of losing something, you are hard. To the degree that you're prepared to let anything whatever go, be lost, you are like the jellyfish with the thinnest of thin membranes. And you can say, the Atman, that relaxed jellyfish, cannot be hurt. Trevor showed me a photograph recently where a drop of water was dropping through a drop of water, which was a bubble. Get some water, blow it up, make a bubble, and then let water drip through that bubble, and it fell straight through, and the bubble remained a bubble. It had penetrated through the bubble, but the bubble hadn't burst. Nice picture that, Trevor, wasn't it? Can you imagine a simple little experiment? You blow a bubble, it's made of water, surrounding air, and then you let water drip onto it in separate drops like this, and it drops straight through the bubble without bursting it. As the particles and the charges electrically approach, the bubble lets them through like that. Whatever goes, it just lets it through. Now, if a human being could do this, that is to say, be transparent, let every attack go through, every rude word go through and close, and retain yourself without bursting, you stand what that bubble can do. So apparently the lowest an object of scientific research, a mere bubble, illustrates a very high principle. If you can take an insult and remain yourself undisturbed and let the insult go through, you're as clever as that bubble. Now imagine again this cosmic ocean, the Brahman, and inside it myriads and myriads of Atmanics, that is selves, closed forms, but so tenuous they can feel every movement of the Brahman, every movement of that macrocosmic ocean, they can feel it. Can you see how sensitive they are? They can feel the Gulf Stream on that side, not that side. They can feel temperature differences, and then by changing their shape in the water, they can travel. You know, there's a fish shape. A normal fish is a double wedge, which is such that the pressure of the water helps it to swim. Now imagine in the same way a jellyfish going along, and on one side the air, part of the Irish Sea is cool, and on this side the Gulf Stream is coming, and it feels that's warmer than that. So the pressure is greater on the cold side than the hot side to it, because the pressure is contracting on the cold side. And all the jellyfish does is alter its shape a little bit, and it goes like that and goes into the warm water of the Gulf Stream. And it's done it by super sensitivity. Now at our level, called the Atmanic level, the real self, the membrane is so thin it can feel every intention of the megalocosmos, the Brahman. Feel the intention of surrounding space. Feel the gradients of destiny. And then just alter your shape a little bit. And off you go to fulfill the destiny. But if you come down to contract yourself and surround yourself with calcium and mineral salts and harden yourself, you cannot feel the subtle energies of the Brahmanic ocean. So you don't have a destiny. You have fate. Now destiny means having somewhere valuable to go. And fate means what befalls you because you are crucified. Remember that FT in fate, it's the same as the PD in PED, and the FT in foot. Phallus, crucifixion. Fate happens to the beings that are identified with sexual self-imagery. They want to be potent, they want to be big, they want to be impressive, and because of that they react to every flattering word, to every coaxing, to every temptation, and that reaction is fate. It's not destiny. Destiny is why, in your supersensitivity, you know that there's a line of least resistance that way towards success in any field. You're so sensitive, you don't shut down. And if something comes at you, an arrow, a bullet, any energy whatever, any weapon, an intercontinental ballistic missile, whatever it is, comes at you, and you look at it with interest, and you open like that and let it through, and close again on your being. That's an interesting boom going through. You can describe it, you can describe the alteration of your temperature in its passage, but you have become invulnerable. You are not woundable if you can open up in that way. You open up and you close. And you do it immediately. You don't wait. As soon as the thing hits you, you open up. Did any of you see the Aikido program recently? Did you see a fellow of about 70-odd turning a very much younger man around like this? Now, he did it by speed and one knowledge. The universe is a sphere. There are no straight lines. So do not oppose a force that attacks you with another force opposite in line with it. Move at right angles. Have you all done that exercise with each other before? Just turn to a person next to you and agree to press your hands together like that. Just press hands with somebody next to you. And then one of you agrees to keep pressing like that, and the other agrees, instead of pushing back, you will move at right angles like that. When you do that with the person next to you, take a hand, press it, agree to resist first, and then one of you moves sideways and see what happens. Now move sideways instead of opposing, and what happens? Did you notice a general raising of the temperature? You know, we've actually added a few calories in the room. Who needs electric heating? The thing is, if you oppose in the same direction as if the bubble, seeing a drop of water falling on it, hardened and went bang at the bubble. Taking the bubble to hit that little drop of water, and it would cease to be what it was, a supersensitive sensorium opening to an experience. Now, if you can open to an experience and still remember who you are, and who you are is a zone of sentient power, you can let the experience go right through you and still be you, and you're not insulted. Now, if somebody's trying to insult you and you're not insulted, they're insulted, because their insults are impotent. It's called by Jesus putting coals of fire on heads of opponents. Don't react, don't get mad at them. Take the criticism, examine it very carefully, and immediately let it go through, and then say, next criticism, please. And it's funny, the temperature of the opponent goes up, and his brain works quicker. He gets smarter. So you're actually doing him a service by wakening his brain up by non-resistance. Now, within this cosmic ocean, imagine all the corks. Do it in the bath at home, or in a bowl if you haven't got a bath. Most people can afford a small bowl, or even a cup. And put some little floaters in it, corks from Guinness bottles, or whatever you're used to, Or champagne, who knows? Let them bounce up and down. I don't like champagne. Let them bounce up and down. Then get a pencil. Let the water go flat. And all the corks are there, waiting. And you're going to pray para, Brahman. You're going to come in with a bit of grace, disguised as a pencil. And you select a given cork and you suddenly hit it. What happens to the cork? It starts bouncing. What happens to the water? The water vibrates. What happens to the other corks? They also respond, don't they? And unless they're very super subtle sage type corks, that let the stimulus of the water go through them and close again, they start bubbling up and down in reaction to the initiating force that hit the first cork. Would you believe that that is the key to all that this world calls success? Now Peter said, the cork that knows that Jiva, Atman, Brahman are none different has understood it. So that if another cork is hit by grace and bounces, instead of reacting to it, it goes still. You let the motion go through you, you don't get mad with the initiator, you don't end with the initiator, you say, so unfortunate mortal who's been inspired. Poor fellow. You see all the other corks bubbling up and down, annoyed, and you sit still. How does it feel like when everybody's gone mad? If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and really it's on you, you'll be a man like Sam. Oh yes, they are. But unless they use the bit they get, they react to the bit the other fellow got. Everybody gets some at their Atman level. And at Atman level, they all get the same amount. But at the Jiva level, where the crab has made a hard shell, they defend themselves unequally, and therefore their talents are unequal, because they're so busy self-defending unequally. And you know, no two human beings have the same degree of energy of self-defense. And that has quite a lot to do with the nation, the people from which you derive. Some nations are bashing-type nations and some are not. Those of you who saw the Japanese film on karate and then the Indian one on Kalari saw something totally different. Men of strength and violence in the first one and men terribly supple and quick in the other one. That's to do with nationality, with race, with experience, with terrain, with climate, with involved experience. I can't press my hand back and make my fingers touch my forearm, but I've got several Indian friends who can. I'm unfortunate. If I could do that, I'd be a bit looser than I am, but I can't do it, so I accept it. I'm cursed with a Caucasian curse on one side of the family. Yeah, rigid. Terrible, isn't it? But I have to put up with it. It's part of my fate, if I react to it. And it could be part of my destiny, if I'm transparent to it. Now, imagine, remember, the jellyfish is only the ocean with a thin skin around it, and the skin is made of the same energy as the jellyfish and the ocean. So there's absolutely no difference whatever between para, Brahman, Brahman, Atman, Jiva. The Jiva, the empirical egotism in you. The Atman, your real, intelligent, spiritual self. The Brahman, the cosmic self. And the beyond self, the infinite. There is no difference other than mode of actuality. That the mode of actuality depends on your will to use your intelligence. Now we're all threefold beings slung on a coordinator. We think, we feel, we activate will, drive, and we have a spine to coordinate them. We can activate ourselves by thinking or feeling or willing. quite different from other people. The more we become reflexively aware that our thought is our will, our feeling is our will, our physical action is our will, all will expressed in different ways. And then from history, some people have been brought up to be superior. A Brahmin friend of mine will not eat if the shadow of another Indian falls on his plate. That's the way he's been brought up. And he hasn't yet broken his education. Now, I don't know whether any of you have been in the Paris metro and happened to get next to a humming tramp. Have you ever been near? Most people would say an unfortunate. Yeah. But it's not. It's the ones that get near him that are unfortunate. He can't smell it. But around him, and the clothes were given to him in 1902 and have not yet been changed. And as he moves, very minute particles ascend in the atmosphere. And all the other people in the underground lean out like this. And it's a lovely rosette pattern as seen from above. That's God to your point. God is interested in such rosettes. Yeah? Now imagine each cork bubbling up and down in response either to an immediate input of grace, energy from Para through Brahman to Atman, or reactively through fear, or even worse, when two corks are driven by waves and hit each other in the relation we call contingency. Contingency means with touch. If two corks hit each other, they vibrate and they obscure their spontaneous awareness of the Brahman cosmic ocean, and they confuse, they turbulate the water in which they both are. They can't see the pattern of their own beings because of their contingent mutual stimulation. You get that with human beings. If one fellow's in a bad temper and says something rude to another fellow who reacts in a bad-tempered way, and then they both get very bad-tempered and they involve everybody else. This can be verified in any public house on Saturday night. If you wish to go there and start a fight, it's quite easy. You wait till about 10 minutes before closing time, and then make a statement about a major religion or political view. And immediately the temperature changes. Lots of contingencies start. The best thing to do is go and sit down quietly in a corner if you can't get out through the door. And watch, observe, and be like the bubble that lets the stimulus go through. Can be very educational. Now, we have to remember the jiva, that is your empirical ego itself, the Atman, that's your true spiritual self, separated only by a very thin membrane from the Brahman, which is a great cosmic self, and the Para Brahman goes beyond all that and at the same time permeates every layer within it. The Para Brahman penetrates the Brahman with the Para Brahman penetrates the Atman penetrates the Jiva, the individual empirical ego, and that thing penetrates nothing, unless it gets down to using swords, daggers, guns, and so on, in the contingent relation with other identified egoic structures. Now, when any energy cannot be assimilated, a reactive cork bouncing up and down is partially destroyed by the unassimilated energy. Not by the assimilated, by the unassimilated. When the stimulus comes and hits you, you can assimilate it to a degree. The part that you assimilate doesn't do you any harm. But the part that you don't assimilate starts to destroy the pattern of the energies within you. Therefore, to be free from damage, one must be totally transparent, totally able to let these stimuli through, and at the same time very alert, very awake, to see what it is that's going through the bubble. And what happens if we say a person, a cork, a jiva, an empirical egoic being, decides to shut down very tightly and fight at contingent level and strike and strike and counter strike? Each blow bruises, that is to say, damages the energy structure of the individual that it's fighting, and at the same time is damaging its own knuckles. Some of you boys will remember thumping somebody and wishing you hadn't. Do you remember as a small boy, before you knew how to make a fist properly, and hitting somebody incorrectly and hurting your knuckles? Do you remember? Or were you always able to make a good fist? And somewhere in the world the other fellow is remembering. He's now a simulation of the blow. When the energy input is too great to assimilate, part or whole of the recipient is destroyed. Now we have levels of being. Physical destruction is one, emotional destruction is another, mentational destruction, that's the time ideas you have, conceptual destruction, your governing concept of what the world is about, volitional destruction means that you are discouraged because of the failure of the other four and you don't will. And then your zone of awareness becomes totally turbulated and you can't do anything. And these things are going on at every level. You can't touch the physical body of another person without creating a feeling state, like or dislike. You can't do that without making them think a bit mentationally in the time in which you do it. You can't do that without rousing in them a conceptual structure of forms which belong to eternity. You can't do that without the will being presented with a situation to which it may or may not respond. If it responds mechanically, it's no longer will. If it responds consciously and deliberately with full awareness, it's still will and is not damaged. Now imagine the ocean full of corks bubbling up and down. Try it in the bath. Verify that every time you hit a cork, the motion from the cork goes through the water and makes the other corks go up and down. Then it's possible to get hold of one cork just as it's about to rise and put your finger on it to stop the rise. That's what Peter was meaning. You can get hold of yourself. I mean that you can see that you are a power of self-determination. You can actually hang on to your own being. You can have such a concept of your being as a zone of sentient power, utterly self-determined, absolutely valid, backed by Brahman, Parabrahman, by God and Godhead, to be you in the place where you are. And when you do that, you are invulnerable. No matter what happens, you will not be hurt, because you are not identified. You have not shut down and tried to stop the simulation. Keep repeating to yourself this: all matter is energy. The energy is not confined to bodies. It radiates, and it's through all space. There is no space that is not full of energy. Real space is solid power. And that solid power, with its intentions within it, makes the little spheres with their very fine envelopes, like the jellyfish, the monad, the spiritual half-man. And then that half-man has the power vested in it, vested means dressed in that thin membrane. The power of the Absolute is inside that being. You have absolute power inside you, and there is only one thing against it: inertia of miseducation. The Sanskrit word there, moha, means stupidity, dull wittedness, ignorance. You don't know who you are. You don't know that you're absolute. You don't know that you're infinite. You don't know that the membrane that surrounds your body is only power within power, within power. And you fall into thinking that you're an individual, existential, material being, subject to the laws of matter and inertia and the tyranny of memory and habit. And you can easily see why one great sage said, if you want freedom, it's easy. Don't have habits. Whatever it is, don't have a habit. Physically, emotionally, mentally, conceptually. You couldn't have one of volition, because volition means initiative. Don't have those four habits. A habit of conceptualizing yourself as a knowledgeable being. A habit of knowing about time events and world history. What year was it that the Germans invaded Belgium in the beginning of the 14th war? What day was it? If you have that kind of memory, you say, I'm clever. And you can then think and repeat and repeat, and then you have to go to a pub where people want to hear about it and sit there and pontificate about temporal events. You might have met people that know a particular period so intimately that you can get a free lecture without going to a university, just by accepting an invitation to coffee. You can become very wise if you pick your coffee mornings properly. Save money. When we remember this, we are utterly self-determined. The empirical ego, jiva, the Atman, the spiritual self, zoned in a fine membrane, the Brahman, the macrocosmic self, and the para-Brahman, which interpenetrates all, they're all there, simultaneously operating. So if you say, bend a finger, who is bending it? The answer is, in the full act, the bend of the finger is your empirical ego accepting the energy given to it by the Atman, the spiritual self, accepting the energy of the Brahman, accepting the energy of the para-Brahman. So, then when you do that, God is doing it. And beyond God is God the Father of Gods, called the Godhead in theology. Who is bending the finger? All of it's bending the finger. And we have another expression, para para. That means beyond beyondness. You see, we've started with a little body and expanded it till we get to the infinite. Para Brahman. And if we go para para, beyond beyondness, we come back in and incarnate. Now feel inside your body, who is beating your heart? Is it your empirical egotism? No, can't be, because you only acquired that through miseducation after birth. What it is that is formulating that heart and beating it inside an embryo, you get a stomach scanner today, you can see babies in the womb with their little pulsings and gradually forming organs. Who is forming the organ in that developing protoplasmic mass? Who is it that divides the one cell into two and four, eight, 16? Who is it? Not the empirical ego. It is the para-para. It's the absolute infinite focusing inward to make a new being. Now when you get slapped when you're born, that's a contingent stimulus that threatens to destroy your awareness of your absolute origin. And then you become afraid, and like the crab you harden. You're frightened to speak in your mind. Is there a person here afraid to speak about anything? If so, let him stand up and speak about that which he doesn't wish to speak about, and he will conquer the inertias of empirical, badly trained egotism. When I was Andrew's age and earlier, I had a funny habit of saying things that were deliberately designed to test the responses of political figures. So he used to go in the best seats. I remember the time it was 2 guineas to see Oswald Mosley. There were cheaper seats. But if you were in the best seats, you were assumed to be a fascist. So they didn't expect interruptions from the few front rows. And I and a few friends of mine used to sit on the front row and then heckle from there. Because the fundamental idea of fascism is that a mass of stupid, ignorant people can be controlled either by one man or an oligarchy, a few men who are so cunning, so powerful, they can make a mass of people count themselves as nothing but tools of the few. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I was cursed with individuality. Remember, curse means run, round. Insofar as you're prepared to affirm your individuality internally, you don't need to shut it out. Or you could, depending on how much nuisance you wish to let loose. But insofar as you affirm your innermost self-determination, you are necessarily against the fascist concept. You believe that every individual, every jiva, is nothing but para Brahman, Brahman, Atman, incarnate in a living human being. And that no one, no matter how big, how old, how physically strong, how mentally clever, is in any way justified in making you from outside by contingency do something that you do not will to do. And if you are transparent, if you're not hardened with fear like the crab, you can feel, like the jellyfish in the ocean, the currents. You can actually feel a movement amongst the crowd, like I felt on one occasion, a movement of a lead pipe going through the air before it was raised. So it was not on my neck that it landed. On that occasion it landed on the neck of Oswald Mosley, who was the British representative of the Hitler-Mussolini clan. If you're quite sensitive, you can feel the crowd moving. And you can feel where they're moving, and you can say, this way, gentlemen, and let them go by. If you're very smart, you can have a little chestnut stand for later, selling hot chestnuts. There is no situation that you can't sell something. But your sensitivity to the movement of the ocean, it's essential to know what that commodity is. Now, how do you all feel if you say to yourself, God is a God of the living? You know, you repeat it. God is the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, and so on. You don't say he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because that would be a group. He's not the God of a group. He's the God of every human, individual, spiritual self. And therefore it has to be your God for you, individually, whoever you are. He's got to be your God, not just the God of humanity at large. And that God is free, initiative, here operative, now spiritual being.